Welcome to Forging Links. Forging Links is the voice of European social democratic activists with an Anglo-Dutch flavor. The podcast is an initiative of A-Union and the platform aiming to empower political activists by developing their skill sets, sharing their stories, and generating social, environmental, economic impact. We're trying to promote the idea of politics with love, solidarity, and prosperity. If you want to know more about A-Union, you can visit our website. We'd like to take this opportunity to thank Dunn Street and the people from Socially Democratic Podcast who have helped us behind the scene, our producer, Mike, and most importantly, you for listening. So, enjoy. Thank you very much. Floris Burgers, how you doing, mate?
I'm doing great, Ali. I'm very excited to be on this Forging Links podcast. So I look forward to the next hour.
Excellent, excellent. So we're going to just go through your journey as a social democrat, as a politically active in the Netherlands, across Europe, and some of your professional experience, but also what inspired you to become active and your personal journey in politics. So,
sounds lovely.
Excellent. So I know you through the Pivotal Academy. Been about 2 years now we've been doing that together, and a few other people. Previously we had other members of the Pivendaar Academy with us. How's that been for you so far?
It's been amazing, actually. It's been amazing. You know, when you're a social democrat like me, trying to make this world a better place from a particular perspective, it's wonderful to meet people who think about the world in a similar way and have the same mission as you have, especially when these people are also young and excited to make a change. So that's been a great experience for me. I found it lovely joining the Pivotal Academy and being with you and all the others in the past 2 years.
Excellent. So it's been about 2 years now. What we do is every month we come together and we kind of set up a program to support each other to grow and learn, and this podcast is one of those things that we put together via that and inspired by that program. So start off with, tell us about yourself. Who is Floris Burgers?
Well, that's an interesting question. So I was born in Wijchen, which is a small town, really. I think it's a village formally, but I'd say it has the size of a town near Nijmegen. And that's where I grew up, in a middle-class family. My father was a teacher at a high school, and my mother worked for a social housing institute. And I grew up in a red family, what we call a red family in Dutch, like people who were part of the Labour Party. My father was a Labour Party member. And over there, I like to play football. So I played a lot of football when I was young and grew up, and started to become politically active because I saw some things when I was young that I felt like these things need to be addressed, things that had to do with inequalities. So I started to become politically active. And right now I'm someone who works in academia, working on inequality of opportunity at the moment. And before that, I've worked in Uganda for quite some while, also as an academic, as an anthropologist, researching schooling in a little village. So these are some of the things that I've been doing and that I'm doing right now. And I live in Amsterdam. That might be quite relevant to mention as well. I went to study in Amsterdam a few years ago and I stayed around.
Nice, nice. So tell me, like, was there one key story or one key moment that inspired you to be specifically more active? Because of course, you know, you can choose when you're young, you can choose to do many things.
Yeah.
Was there a five-a-side Labour football team or something? Or
right.
what specifically Labour, like?
There was no five-a-side Labour football team. Although I do tend to think that Labour Party people often play football. I mean, it seems to be a very popular sport among Labour politicians. But anyway, that wasn't the reason. And there wasn't one moment that led me to become politically active. But what happened is that, you know, I used to play football, as I just told you. And football is one of these things that gets you in touch with a very wide range of people with very many different backgrounds. And so when I grew up, I saw how life is different for all these different people. And I also got to see how some young team members of mine actually struggled with life a lot. You know, I was lucky to have a father who brought me to football matches, who was there to support me all the time. But some young talented players who also wanted to become professional football player like I aspired those days, they didn't have that support and they were always on their own. And then, you know, when you grow up in a rat family like I did, you tend to see these things because your parents also make you aware of these inequalities. And then at some point you're like, you know, no, this is something that needs to change. You know, the essence of life is that we try to make life bearable for everybody and give chances to all children. And then you slowly start to become politically active, which was rather early on for me. I think I just joined the university. So right after my high school, I joined the PVDA. And then I also started to support the PVDA team in my local community, Wijchen, at the time.
Nice. So you've got that trying to fight for opportunities really early on, really stuck into your, you know, starts from your values. And then how did that probably influenced your academic career after university?
Right, yeah.
Or even during?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So it has greatly influenced my academic career, I think, because early on I felt like I want to do something with inequalities and I want to work on that. So as a young person, one of the things that that I felt was, you know, a very unequal thing in this world is that people in other countries in the global south have much less opportunities than people over here have. So I thought that was, you know, one of the most fundamental inequalities that we were having and that we're still having. So I decided to start to do work in Africa, to focus, you know, academically on Africa and in particular Uganda. So after my studies, I decided to do a PhD, and then I decided to go and live in a community in Uganda to learn more about what it is to live in poverty, and what poverty actually means. Because, you know, when you want to make a change for people who are marginalized, who are living in poverty, really, you need to get to know them very well, isn't it? And anthropology, my discipline, gives you the opportunity to get to know marginalized people better. So I went to Uganda and lived in a village for 2 years to you know, find out what life is like for people who live under these circumstances. So that's how it's been steering my academic career. And then of recent, I started to again work on the theme of inequality, which is the theme of inequality of opportunities in Dutch education. So whatever I do in academia is always about inequalities and trying to give people opportunities.
So if you look at this idea of inequality, most of the time you get this kind of critique that inequality is relative. So, I mean, you started off your academic career studying poverty or inequality in Uganda.
Yeah.
Which is a very different economy, social, political environment to what you have here in the Netherlands or in Europe.
Yeah.
That difference, some would say, you know, in relative terms, it's pretty equal in the Netherlands compared to Uganda.
Yeah.
So how's that contrast been for you in terms of trying to make improvements? Or do we have the wrong idea about inequality's existence in the Netherlands and in Europe?
No, it's relative, you know, it's definitely relative. So, you know, people over here who are, you know, who are considered poor and live under very bad conditions, these people have more facilities than the poor in Uganda have. You know, here, you know, although there are some people who don't have homes, like there are a lot of people who are considered poor, but they have houses and proper houses made of stone and all that. Although these houses might have issues as well, but you know, they're at least made of stone. In Uganda, you've got people living in mud houses without a proper roof, a roof that's leaky all the time. People have no beds, all that. So there's definitely, you know, poverty is relative. But at the same time, you know, being in a situation of poverty also has very many similarities. For example, the stress that comes with poverty, that's something that all people experience. And then also what I find very important is that, you know, poverty is always systemic. So it's something that's produced by the system that we live in. People in Uganda who are poor and increasingly worse off, for example, suffer from climate change, which is something that we are causing as a human being through, you know, a capitalist system that we're involved in. So that's systemic poverty. The same thing is happening, you know, in the Netherlands, where people suffer from a toeslagen system that is really, you know, not helping them at all, and are suffering from the fact that we don't tax wealth as much as we tax income. So poverty is always systemic. So as much as it's relative, there are, you know, general patterns that cause inequality, that make people suffer, and we as social democrats, we try to challenge these systems. And that's also why I like social democracy. You know, it's a philosophy that focuses on, you know, systemic changes. It's not like, you know, community thinkers like who say, you know, we just need to look after each other. Let's just, you know, create communities and look after each other. It all needs to come from the people. No, inequality is in the system. So solidarity should be, you know, be put into the system.
If you're saying like solidarity needs to be put into the system, doesn't that defeat the voluntary aspect of solidarity? So isn't that an enforced solidarity?
I see it as and, you know, you don't have to say, let's put it in the system and then we all just think about ourselves, right? You can say, I think we need to, you know, design systems that involve solidarity. And at the same time, we need to encourage each other to continue to look after each other, right? So it's and. And I also really like politicians who have tried to do that. So people like, you know, Joop den Uyl a very long time ago, or someone like Eberhard van der Laan more recently, a Labour Party mayor in Amsterdam. These were really people who focused on how the system produces inequalities. But there are also people who were father figures, really trying to tell people to look after your neighbors, your friends, your relatives. So that's sort of the kind of thing that I find very important. Solidarity in the system, but also in people.
And then if we go back to the climate change impact that you mentioned in Uganda, how is that physically manifested there? How have you witnessed its physical manifestation in terms of impact of climate change?
So in Uganda, the village in which I lived, people live from farming. So every family has a small plot of land, and, you know, they grow food on that land, and they grow just enough to make a living, really. And even when people have good harvests, they usually have just enough to feed their families. But with climate change, the rains are becoming more and more variable in Uganda. And consequently, you see that many farmers don't have as good harvests as they used to have anymore. And consequently, you know, sometimes they lack a proper harvest, which means that they need to sell cows to get some money to buy food rather than eat fruit from the land. You know, and when you keep off selling cows, at some point you don't have cows anymore. So people really end up in very harsh and stressful situations. And then at some point people need to make choices. What am I going to do? Am I going to buy more food, meaning that I can't send my children to school anymore? Or am I going to, you know, not send my children to school? And then, or am I going to suffer from hunger and send my children to school? So these kind of very harsh choices at some point need to be made by people. And yeah, that's a clear manifestation of climate.
So you did your doctorate based on the 2 years that you spent in Uganda?
Yeah,
and that doctorate, you've produced a book about, as a result of it.
Yeah.
You basically, I mean, a European visiting a very non-European area. If I use political identity terms, I would say, you know, a white person going to visit a Black African village and studying them as if they are some kind of, you know, a case study of such.
Yeah.
You always hear about the, you know, volunteers going to Africa trying to be like these saviors,
yeah,
or the term, I don't like the term, but
yeah,
term of white savior.
Yeah.
How do you experience that?
That's a great question. So I need to differentiate here very clearly between what I did and what some of these volunteers do. So what you see in Africa and Uganda as well is volunteers who go there, usually as part of a development organization, which has a very clear philosophy. And then they're going to change people in Africa. And you see very, very, very odd examples of that when you're in Uganda. You see very young children. You see children who just graduated from high school, and then they're going to teach Ugandan women how to become good business people or whatever. Well, they have no idea what life in Uganda is like. Well, these women have much more knowledge and experience with doing business in Uganda. So this is very, you know, that's very odd. It's really, you know, white people experiencing colonial privileges in Uganda and also being very arrogant towards people, reproducing hierarchies. But what I did as an anthropologist is I went there to learn from these people. So I went to live in a village. So rather than living in a large villa surrounded by very beautiful animals, like, you know, the old colonizers used to do, I lived in a very small house in a village to experience what it's like to live in such a village. And then I worked very closely with Ugandan people. So it was not like me sitting there studying them. And it was like I was continuously doing things with the community to understand, you know, what it's like to be part of that community. And I tried as much as possible to be very modest when I was there. So not trying to, you know, enjoy the privileges that inevitably come my way when I'm as a white person in a country like Uganda. And so that's something that's really different, I think. I must say that eventually I wrote the book, so there is a degree of, you know, hierarchy right there. So we did this work together with the community, and eventually I wrote a book about it, and they had little to say about what's in that book. But that's also, again, because of the system. You know, as a PhD scholar, you need to produce a book, and you can't produce it with people. But in future work, I would love to do that. I would love to, you know, change this book into a new book and then co-author it with the many people I work with in Uganda.
I want to ask something specific about, did you experience getting sick and during those 2 years? And how was that compared to how when people get unwell in the village?
So I did experience being sick because one of the things I did to make friends in the community and to be part of the community is playing football with them, because football is a very popular sport in Uganda. And it's something I like to do and can do. So that's what I did. But then the pitches over there are not what I'm used to. They are much more hilly. And these young African players are very good at managing that. That's very interesting. You'll find pitches with holes and everything, and they just, you know, manage to play football and then go around these holes. But I don't, obviously. So I fell down all the time, and then at some point I got my arm dislocated, which was very painful. And then, you know, here's when, you know, being white helps. So it's a good question. So I managed to go to a very good hospital. You know, get my arm recovered there, and I never suffered from that arm again. But you would probably see that an African person who lacks money, you know, will have to have their arm being put in place again by a friend in the community who doesn't have expertise on arm dislocations. That may go wrong, and consequently that person will suffer from that arm dislocation for the rest of their lives. So I'm not saying that I'm, you know, you can't be equal. And, you know, I can try to understand what poverty is, but until you've experienced it yourself, you never know. So definitely I've enjoyed white privileges in
I think one of my heroes is George Orwell, and he traveled, or Eric Blair, he traveled to experience poverty in London, in Paris, and, you know, even when he embedded himself in Catalonia, his production, of course, as a journalist, was writing. And of course, as a result of his writing, we got, you know, wonderful novels, wonderful works of nonfiction. The way I saw it is that he goes into these situations knowing that he can actually escape it, knowing he can always, for example, sometimes he got unwell, he can go back home or to a friend's house in London, recover, and then go back onto the streets. But his main achievements was communicating the suffering, the situation, back to people within his own economic, social, political class. Do you see yourself in that circumstance? So rather than seeing it as you're there to save Ugandans or there to save people out of poverty, you're actually there to communicate to people who are not in poverty what they are, you know, what they're, what, why they should be grateful for what they have in comparison to, and how they should respond
yeah.
to helping.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I've not read the books of George Orwell, but hearing from you what kind of things he wrote about, I'm going to read them right away, because that's exactly the kind of thing that I hope to do with my work in Uganda, but also in the future. When it comes to my work in the Netherlands on inequalities of opportunities, I really want to understand the situation of marginalized people, and then help to communicate that situation to a broader public. But then also, I'm not sure if George Orwell did that, trying to come up with solutions. So that's where the politics comes in, right? So I'm not just a journalist who writes, but I also try to think about, you know, if we want to improve the lives of people, so what is it then that we need to do given the circumstances they're in, and that I hopefully managed to understand very well.
So when you're talking about systemic change and changing the system, yeah. Is there a specific tool other than politics that you think that we need to work on? Because if you've got academia produces works of study, they may inspire policy, and then you have politics is mostly campaigning. Politics, especially when you can't be in government or you're not in government. Is there something in between that you think can be achieved that is undervalued at the moment, or something you'd like to work on?
Well, I think academics, and that also applies a little bit to journalists, is not only that they can influence policy in the sense that they do a research and then they call a policy maker and say, well, this is what the research has, go and change policy. I also think that they can, you know, change people's thoughts and people's reflections. You know, when you write a great book, or you make a great documentary on what's going wrong with the system and how that affects the lives of people, you can actually, you know, make people aware of these things. And you'll find that people then will start to support your solutions or start to find that an important theme. And potentially when you're a politician or when you're affiliated to a party like I am, then they may eventually start to vote for your party. And, you know, the solution that your party propose will be accepted more. So that's something that I would like to do, not just doing a research and then call a policymaker and fix everything behind the scenes, but trying to change people's ideas as to what's the system about, how is it affecting people, and how does it need to change. Which so is very I know vicious, from... but anyway, yeah, that's what I try to do.
So from the work that we've been involved in terms of Pivot Academy, you helped organize one of the first youth level events between the Pevenda and GroenLinks, trying to basically bring more the younger people, the people who are not necessarily in power at the moment, not necessarily executives at the moment, or not necessarily even candidates, but are just like activists on the ground, bring them closer together. From my side, it was a very interesting event that we had in, I believe it was in Utrecht.
I think it was in Arnhem.
Arnhem. Yep. My bad. One of the interesting things there was just sharing ideas. And I feel like one of the, when we were talking together, we were talking from the side of, I'm here as a Pivindar activist or Labour Party activist. They're here from a Green Party side. And you can see there is this almost each one trying to protect their domain. And it wasn't as mutual as I thought. What I mean by that is when we were discussing topics of economic system, we were talking about topics of immigration. It was always like, if you're a Green Party member, you came from an environmental angle. And if you were a Pivindar member, you came from a kind of a people angle or economic angle or working aspect of the immigration issue. And I found that very interesting to be confronted with it, where you have each one coming from their own side, let's just say.
Yes.
Tell me more about your experience. First, your ideas about the merger or the cooperating with the Green Party, but also if you experience something similar with this, each one coming from their own viewpoint.
Right. So I was actually very skeptical about this collaboration in the beginning, because, you know, as we've just been discussing, I find it very important that when you're trying to make a change for particular groups of people, which in the case of social democrats is usually marginalized people, I think you need to understand them very well. And ideally, your party is made up of people who have such a background, who are marginalized. And, you know, the PvdA always used to be like that. It used to be a party made up of labor class people. And we're increasingly losing that, I feel. We're increasingly a party of people who actually, well, you know, like me as well, who didn't suffer from poverty, really, and who had lots of opportunities and who are eventually becoming highly educated and so on. And I actually felt we need to go back to the people that we're trying to make a change for, which means including them more in our parties, but also, you know, becoming anthropologists, really, trying to go back to the communities that we try to work for and work with. And then GroenLinks all of a sudden joined our movement. And I thought, to a degree, I still think a little bit like that. I thought that they are typically not these people, right? They are often very young, highly educated people living in cities, being part of universities, very concerned with, you know, environment, but not that concerned with poverty and inequality. And so I was like, no, we shouldn't join these people. We need to go to a completely different direction. But then I got to know these people more. You know, that view I was sharing was more based on my own bias. I got to know these people more during events like the one you just mentioned, the one I helped to organize. And then I increasingly felt that, you know, many of these GroenLinks people are very interested in inequalities. And they, you know, they usually start to talk about climate first, and then, you know, they end up talking about inequality. And we talk about inequalities first, and then we end up talking about climate change as well. But I often felt that, you know, these people are very aware of the fact that when you want to address climate change, you also need to think about, you know, what's the climate transition going to do with inequalities, and how do we make sure that as part of the climate transition, we make sure that we also address inequalities. People seem to be very, you know, interested in that. So then I was like, you know what, maybe we can actually learn a lot from each other, because these people have a lot of expertise on how you can, you know, change the climate, because that's been their main thing for the past 30 years, isn't it? We have a lot of expertise on how you can, you know, address inequalities. So, you know, let's just work together, and then together also make sure that we include, you know, people with different backgrounds into our party. And when I look at the list that we developed, the PvdA GroenLinks list, right, the Tweede Kamerverkiezingen list, you see that it's a very diverse list. So that's, you know, it shows me that the party is really trying to do what I would hope they would do, that's being very inclusive.
Yeah. So if you're looking at this kind of event, well, we have the merger within the campaign itself. So for the parliamentary elections, there is a single list from both parties coming together. And I think that's going to, if if there is a substantial victory of that model, and there is a gain of, you know, either we are part of a coalition government in terms of supporters of a coalition government or leading a coalition government, I think it will basically be a sign for especially people within our party to now really consider a substantial merger or a substantial work, joint work. Because technically speaking, Frans Timmermans is number one on the list. He will be leading, he will not be leading the Labour Party. He'll be leading both parties in Parliament.
Excellent.
So it's already in Parliament within that realm, they're already joint. And then also, if you look at this, the first chamber, the Eerste Kamer, it's also the same thing. The both parties now are in a, they call it a faction, but I think it's essentially one block. Do you see a future in that kind of in winning? Do you see there is a future for the Labour Party?
I do.
As it's currently structured or its heritage?
So I think that you know that you know, combining these two parties into a new movement, which is these days called Verenigd Links, right? That's sort of the name that we've adopted to capture the joint list of the PvdA and GroenLinks. I do that this party, this collaborative party, has great potential. Because you know what? Climate change is going to be there for the next 40, 50 years. That's going to be the main theme of our generation, I believe. So when you have a party who has a very strong story with regard to climate change, that also includes, you know, addressing inequality and fighting for more equality, that's a great story. That's going to be at the heart of what politics is going to be about in the next 50 years. So I definitely see potential, but I only see potential when that party is going to be an inclusive party and not a party for only highly educated people. When it's a party for, you know, for very many different people, and also people who are minorities and who are marginalized. And only if the knowledge of these people is included in the party, that's when it will be successful. I truly believe that. Yeah.
It's interesting that you say, like, I think at some point both parties are now fully entrenched, the majority of which are maybe middle class, educated. It's very, I would say it's not difficult, but it's very challenging to actually give somebody an opportunity within the party who comes from a background of, who doesn't come from background, but like currently lives in poverty, currently lives on the living wage, or even less so on the minimum wage. People don't have time to be active when they are just struggling to make a living, when they're struggling to pay energy bills, when they are struggling to get to work, predominantly through personal transport. So, and most people who have to change from a diesel car to a petrol car are people who disproportionately come, you know, are less well off to actually make that change or transition.
Yeah.
When you're faced with all of these barriers to activism, how would you like to see the party move towards opening opportunities for people of diverse backgrounds more than what it's currently doing?
Right. So I completely agree with you. When you're experiencing the stress of being, you know, in a situation of poverty, it's very hard for you to become politically active. The only thing you can think about is how am I going to get food or money for tomorrow, right? So I don't think it's possible to, you know, have very many people who actually experience poverty to be part of your party. But what I do think is possible is that the people who are part of our party, that they can live in these communities, make sure that they know very well what it is to live in poverty. So I don't have something against, you know, highly educated people. I'm one myself, really. I don't have anything against, you know, rich people joining the Labour Party. What I find very difficult is that when we are a party that is composed of only these kind of people, And at the same time, they own, these people all live, you know, in their own bubble in cities surrounded by privileged people. You know, it's very fine if, you know, middle-class people, highly educated people, or elites, whatever, join our party, but make sure that we live in the communities that we're trying to make a change for. And I'm not always doing that myself. You know, I also live in academic bubbles, and at the moment I live in a neighborhood which is full of, you know, in Amsterdam, find very highly educated expats who are relatively rich. So I could do better myself, but I think we should all try to make sure that we surround ourselves with the people that we're trying to change and hear from them how we we're not trying to change the people, we're trying to change the situation they're in. And we need to learn from them how we need to do that. Then we're also including them in our movement, aren't we? Although indirectly.
I mean, there's an argument there that the party does not necessarily represent at the moment people who are of the traditional working class. That's referred to the cultural working class. Yeah. So that's people who come from a background where their grandparents or parents used to work in blue-collar jobs.
Right.
And then there you have the other side, people who are unable to, for example, be independent financially, work-wise, who are dependent on social housing, who are dependent on benefit system or tax cuts, or these basically reliant on the existing political system to support them in their livelihood.
Yeah.
There's an argument that the party is does not involve them in its processes, in its activism, and it just targets them by words.
Yeah.
And we see this, for example, with the rise of other populist parties who target the same audience and have been far more successful at attracting that voice. Is it because we're not saying the right things, or is it because the people have shifted their values away from traditional Labour values?
I think it's also partially because we're not saying the right things. Because, you know, you need to know the circumstances of the people you're trying to work for to be able to say the right things. And I think that the PvdA has for a while not been able of doing that because, you know, we've been not very close to these people. But what I also see that this is changing, you know, for example, something like someone like Tim Schongers, who we also got to meet at the meeting in Arnhem, the one we just spoke about. You know, he's someone who really emphasizes, guys, we need to include what he calls, you know, experiential knowledge more in our programs and in our idea development, right? So he says the people who have experienced poverty, who have experienced depth and all that, they should be included in the development of our ideas. So the party is moving towards that more, which is very good, I think. But we've not done it well for a while, but we are now trying to do better, which is great.
Okay, so now just on a more lighter mood, what inspires you politically? Like, which people? You mentioned your parents, but are there certain characters, be it fiction or non-fiction, that inspire you politically?
I like politicians who put emphasis on making our systems of solidarity, but at the same time have this capacity of trying to talk to specific individuals, talk to all of us, and then tell us to look after each other. So these people also manage to boost the solidarity of individuals, solidarity within communities, without necessarily, you know, talking about the system. And people like Joop den Uyl, I hate to, you know, just always keep talking about Joop den Uyl, because, you know, whenever we go to a conference, it's always Joop den Uyl on the screen and all that. I think we should move forward a bit. But he was someone who did that, so that inspires me. Someone like Eberhard van der Laan, I already mentioned him. He does that too. And so these are people who inspire me. Then someone who I really like, not because he's a politician, but because he manages to, you know, share the situation of particular groups within society and with a broader public, is someone like Joris Luyendijk. He's an anthropologist who tends to go to particular communities. He's lived in the Middle East for a very long time. He now wrote a book about, you know, white privilege. And he does that by, you know, showing very clear examples of things that happen in particular contexts. And then he manages to write a book about these examples that is very nice and easy to read. And that really changes people's views, I think. So he's a bit of an example for me as well.
All right, so these are the real people. Is there any like fictional characters that have you've enjoyed even recently? I mean,
so you mean like movie characters and that kind of
movie characters, books.
Oh, that's nice. So I a movie character that I really like. I can't really tell. This is a very good question.
But if it comes to mind, I mean, where do you get your source of politics, as in of ideology, of knowledge? Books, podcasts, where do you?
I would say it's books. I'm a big fan of books. And one book that has really inspired me is a book written by an American woman. She's called Tanya Lee. And she wrote a book about a community in Indonesia. It's an ethnography, so it's an anthropological book. And she writes about that community, and she writes how capitalist relations sort of emerged in that community because of, you know, that community becoming part of the global system. And she shows how very subtly that capitalist system changed relationships between people and made that society become much more individualistic. So it was a society whereby people looked after each other and were great for each other, trying to help out each other. And then all of a sudden, it became a society that was very individualistic and everybody was looking at trying to progress and was in competition with one another. And that's sort of a book that has shown me how, you know, systems change people, systems affect solidarity. And if we don't create systems that, you know, ensure that there is solidarity and that give people the opportunity to continue to look after each other, you know, we are breaking things down. And so these kind of books really inspire me.
Have you been listening to anything in terms of podcasts or
books? I listen to the Yordcast, which is, I don't know if you know it, but it's a podcast by Jort Kelder, who is a bit of an elitist figure, I would say. He's often associated with the right wing political movement in the Netherlands. He's not that right wing, you know. He's also very much in favor of addressing climate change and all that. But I like his style. He's a bit arrogant, but in a way I like. I can't, you know, I can't frame it differently. I it's a guilty pleasure. I like him, and and he interviews doctors and other scientists, so people in academia, professors, about what's going on in life, and he does that in a very funny way, I'd say. So I enjoyed that podcast a lot.
Okay, cool. Well, any final matters that you want to share with people, inspire them, or things that you would like to specifically help you work on? Is there anything you're working on at the moment that you want to bring people towards, or something that you aspire to achieve?
You know what, Ali, when you give me time to talk, you should be very careful, because I can talk for a very long time. you know, So you've been asking questions about who inspires me and all that, and then right away I started to talk about these great politicians and you know, Jobben now. But one person that really inspires me personally, that, you know, keeps me going, is a woman called Nuru Asigali. She lives in Uganda. She was a woman living in my village, and she's someone who experienced extreme setbacks in her life. So she was raised without her parents. Her parents, one died, the other moved away. So she was in another family where she wasn't treated as good as the other children in that family. So she was kind of forced to marry at an early age. She got lots of children, no education, lots of children. And then the husband she married actually started to, he wasn't really looking after her and the children very well. In the beginning he was, but later not anymore. And that woman, she was in a very hard situation, but she just kept working very hard. She just kept working very hard, trying to cultivate her land to get some money. When all the other women were resting in the village, she went out to, buy matoke, which is a local staple food, from other people to go and sell them at the market. She was always working to try and educate her children. And she managed eventually. Most of her children are getting some education and are succeeding in life. So under her circumstances, being so positive and being so strong, that's something that really inspires me. And it sort of remembers me, if she can do that, I can just keep going, whatever happens, with my life and all the and all the good experience I have. When I have a setback or when I have something that affects me, I think about her and I'm like, when she can keep going, I can keep going. So that's actually someone who perhaps inspires me more than any of the people I talked about. So that's perhaps worth sharing in this rather personal podcast as well.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would love to share, I think, more details on that. Does she have a chapter in your book? Or do you mention her in your book?
It's good that you asked. I dedicated the book to her.
Okay.
So I dedicated this book, this book I wrote, my PhD thesis, really, which I turned into a book. I dedicated that book to two people. That's my own mother, Florence, and to Nur Wastigani, because these people show me the way in two different ways. I've told you how Nur Wastigani shows me the way. By being an example of someone who never gives up, despite circumstances. And then my mother, she's also someone who shows me the way, because she's the person who told me to go and study anthropology. When I had to choose a subject to study, I talked about mathematics and in Dutch it's bestuurskunde. I forgot the management science or whatever it's in English, I think. Because that's, these are studies that everybody does, and you get a job easily and you'll get some money and all that. And some people were encouraging me to go and do that. And then she said, man, is that really you? And I was like, you're absolutely right. That's not me. I'm not that kind of person who needs to do that. And she encouraged me to go and study anthropology because I liked it. And she said, that's something that really suits you. So I started doing that, and it's brought me a lot. I'm really happy that I went to study anthropology, and that's because of my mother. So she also showed me the way, like Nur Wastigani is doing. So I dedicated my book to two great mothers who both showed me the way. Fantastic. It's kind of a bit sentimental towards the end of this podcast.
It's a very beautiful sentiment, and I'm glad that you shared with us, and I really appreciate the time you spent with us, and I hope people learn something about how you can make a difference, knowing the fortunes that you have and how you can use that fortune to understand and shed a light on the struggles of other people.
Ali, thanks so much. I really hope that's what I am doing.
Thank you, man.